Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I have a special guest. His name is Marcus House, and he runs a very popular YouTube channel on SpaceX and space exploration. I want to welcome you on the channel, Marcus.
Oh, thanks very much, Dave. It's great to be here. Thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of your videos lately, and I've just been super impressed. And I've got to have you on my channel to unpack SpaceX, Starlink, Starship, Elon Musk. I'm curious, I guess, first off, when did you start your YouTube channel and really start putting out these SpaceX videos? Because everyone I talk to, they're just so amazed by, like, you know, the meticulousness and how much information you pack into each video.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of grown from a love that I had during my teenage years. I didn't really know much about space or anything before that, growing up with media coverage the way it was. I really started loving the topic, you know, watching some of those later shuttle missions as I got old enough. So I'm almost 41. And so, you know, if you go back, you know, teenage years were roughly when the shuttle was still flying before it all stopped in 2011. So just absolutely loved the shuttle, and it was just the most amazing thing to me. And you know, sort of soon after that, you know, I got really interested in this game, Kerbal Space Program, which anybody that follows space closely has probably tinkered with this to some degree, or at least seen people playing it. And the channel itself that I had sort of started growing based on just me playing this game, right? This is a fun little thing, simulations, trying to do all these little moon missions. And even though it's a game, it is incredibly it's incredibly good at teaching you the basic understanding of what's required to get to various places, Mars and this sort of thing. And I think I started doing these program simulations of the SpaceX Falcon 9's landing and also the Falcon Heavy. When that was preparing to take off for the first time, I did all these simulations on how it's going to work, had all these program things, spent ages on this program making it work. And that really got the audience of the channel enthused. And it sort of started to slowly shift from this gaming channel into a SpaceX-focused simulation, and then grew from there into this sort of more news more news and updates following that we've done for the last couple of years. And the audience now has shifted quite substantially. I think we had something like 30,000 followers at the end of the whole Kerbal Space Program thing before we sort of started really transitioning. And obviously it's roughly 10 times that now, right? So, yeah.
What's your background? What did you study in college? Did you have any jobs after that?
I'm actually a programmer. We're primarily a web developer in my other roles. And so I've never had any sort of engineering training, any sort of, you know, no formal training in any of the stuff that we talk about. I just really love it. I'm just a space enthusiast when it comes down to it. And I've just really loved the topic for a long, long time.
Was it kind of like a gradual transition where you just were doing your day job web programming and then you just got more interested and shifted into full-time?
Yeah, definitely a gradual progression. So, you know, as I said, it started off with this game simulation stuff. I was just doing that as a hobby of a night. And we sort of did that for a couple of years. And then just over the course of transitioning into the SpaceX stuff, as the channel got bigger and the YouTube revenue got big enough to start to support me from a revenue point of view, then, you know, I slowly whittled back the time I spent on my other job. I still work my other job on Mondays and sometimes a little bit more than that, just to keep the skills up there. And because I mean, I really love all the people I work with. So
that's awesome. What kind of web programming do you do?
Mainly around PHP, MySQL development, and these sorts of things, just building databases and intranet systems for people and, you know, application systems, all this stuff, which I'm sure most of my audience would find mind-numbingly boring.
It's funny because I actually have a software company myself, 5 or 6 people, and it's like a part-time thing. I might spend like a few hours a week on it, but I'm like hesitant to give it up because it's like the creating of something from scratch and designing. It's so amazing and awesome, you know? And I resonate with you, like, just to keep up those skills a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, programming is kind of it's such a fun thing. And, you know, even when we were, the skills that I was using to, you know, simulate these Falcon 9 landings in Kerbal Space Program using Kerbal Operating System at the time, right? They're all sort of common skills, and they're just very relatable and interesting. And I think that's where I started to really focus in on the love of the engineering and the science behind it and all that sort of thing.
I noticed, like, so I've been following, you know, SpaceX for a while, but I've been more recently kind of getting into the weeds of like all the different channels out there and the community out there. And I'm just so kind of impressed by the devotion, the enthusiasm of the space, you know, community. What's your experience been like, you know, having this YouTube channel, covering this from an in-depth point of view? Like, who are you connecting with? Who are these people out there that are just so devoted, you know, to space? Are they from all walks of life? Are they from different countries? Is there a certain similarity? Are they all aspiring for something or wanting something or hoping something? Like, what brings that all together?
Yeah. The main focus I get, especially from the space enthusiast point of view, the people that aren't on the ground actually, you know, recording this stuff live, I think it's that want and need to explore that really comes down to it and to do things that we've never done before. And I personally find that extremely satisfying to understand, and even watching technical videos about, it doesn't even have to be rocketry. It can be science related in general, what we're capable of doing when we put our minds to it. You've only got to look at how we've, you know, managed to, you know, deal with the pandemic to a degree. You know, it's kind of, it's inspiring to see us break all these boundaries. And, you know, exploration to Mars and survival in space, this sort of stuff is incredibly hard. To even be a part of that and to sort of have a good understanding of it, I think is just such an inspirational thing. But the people down on the ground and the 3D artists out there, they're scattered all over the world. These people are amazing. You've only got to look at a lot of the 3D artists that I present on the channel almost each and every week, and they're scattered all around the world. They've just got a deep love of this stuff. I reach out to all of them I can and communicate with them, and you know, we try to promote each other, and it's this real team space attitude, and many other industries aren't like that. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, I've noticed, like, you know, just all the collabs happening, just like, you know, sharing, yeah, and everyone's this tight kind of creator community around SpaceX. It's amazing. So I want to get into a bunch of like juicy stuff. Talk about, you know, SpaceX versus other companies, Blue Origin, and talk about Starship. I want to go into kind of the bigger picture, like, and then dive in. But let's first dive into Blue Origin a bit. So, you know, Jeff Bezos's company has filed this lawsuit, I guess, against NASA. What is this all about? Like, do they even have a chance of, you know, winning, or will this postpone any of kind of SpaceX's plans with the human landing system? Like, what's your take on kind of this lawsuit?
Well, to a degree, it's already postponing it. So currently, the current standing, as far as I understand, and I may not have this 100% correct, but the current standing is that SpaceX have already been provided with roughly the $330 million for this sort of initial step out of the $3 billion odd that they've been granted, as long as it keeps, you know, continues to go through. You know, Blue Origin, obviously the upper management of that don't like this. They have tried to fight it every step of the way. I find it quite disheartening in a way, because it's very much this Blue Origin versus SpaceX attitude right now. And I try to keep out of that because I don't find it very useful. But man, Blue Origin, the upper levels of Blue Origin are making it hard for the community to not sort of turn against them. I think you've only got to look at the like-dislike ratio of the latest NS-17 mission, and it's clear that they've created a very big divide very quickly. You know, it's unfortunate, because the engineers and the designers at Blue Origin, fantastic people. I've you know, had the pleasure of you know, chatting on and off to the odd person, and terrific people. They're trying to do the best they can. And they deserve all the respect from anyone in the aerospace industry. And in the end, they've sort of got upper management above them. And I can't imagine they're happy with this, this outlook. You know, we've just seen their mission architecture lead of the HLS system at Blue Origin has now left to join SpaceX. And that's something that these people don't take such decisions lightly, I'm sure. And I think that's probably a pretty good indicator of how the, you know, how people are feeling inside Blue Origin right now.
Yeah, definitely. They're taking some risks, you know, like their graphics and all that against SpaceX.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, it's kind of basic marketing, right? You don't need to put everyone else down to make yourself look better. And that very much seems to me to be the tactic of Blue Origin right now. Instead of showing what they can do and showing how theirs is a great system, they raise themselves up by trying to put the others down. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. I would love to see Blue Origin roll out a rocket tomorrow and launch. I would love to see New Glenn launch, and I'd talk about it with the enthusiasm that I talk about SpaceX. It's just unfortunate that we haven't seen things to that degree yet. And there's other things going on as well. I mean, they're the creators of the BE-4 engine. And that, which is an extraordinary engine of itself. You know, people can go through the differences between Raptor versus the BE-4 and this sort of thing as much as they like. Both are US made engines. They help America to get away from Russian supplied engines to a degree a lot more and a lot quicker. And as far as I understand, Tory Bruno, who's obviously leading United Launch Alliance, they are coming to the point now where Tory did tweet the other day that he's confident that the BE-4 engine will be supplied by the end of the year. So let's hope that's true. It would at least be a great thing for Blue Origin to sort of have that that. Yeah, milestone passed.
Yeah, awesome. I opened it up for some questions on Twitter, and Scott Opendry says, "What companies are the best poised to compete with SpaceX?" So yeah, Blue Origin, he thinks, might be the obvious answer, but what about others as Astra, Rocket Lab, Relativity Space? Like, what's your take? Kind of on the take a step back. So obviously, yeah. SpaceX, you know, ahead, but is there a second place right now? Is there any company that you're like, woo, like we need to watch for this company? Is it Relativity Space or Rocket Lab? And what's your take on all this?
Yeah. Look, Relativity Space is a very interesting one. And I don't feel confident that I've got the background to really judge the way they're building the rockets myself to a degree. I really need to understand 3D printing of metals and things to a better degree. What they're saying is quite impressive. I think the Relativity Space rocket, which is the Terran R, that's actually something that's, well, they're saying it's got the potential of delivering, I think it was 20 metric tons to low Earth orbit, fully reusable, which is obviously SpaceX's goal with Starship as well. So it's sort of similar design. Something's going to re-enter in some way. It looks a little similar to Starship in some degree, or the shuttle. You know, the design's still obviously being fleshed out there. So that's Relativity Space. I'm a big fan of Rocket Lab because their coverage is just so beautiful. They've done a lot of great things with the Electron. They've only had a couple of mishaps so far, and they seem to be able to get through those and you know, update the rocket. The next thing for Rocket Lab, though, is Neutron. And the Neutron is as well a pretty impressive sounding vehicle. You know, the inspiration around this stuff is obviously high. And this is unprecedented stuff. Whether SpaceX achieve everything they want to with Starship remains to be seen. Obviously, Rocket Lab coming to the party with the Neutron, which I think is supposed to do around 7 to 8 metric tons of payload to low Earth orbit, which is also fully reusable. Yeah, Astra, we haven't seen a lot with yet. Obviously, we had a sideways launch just the other day, which was kind of entertaining. They lost one engine on the pad just at liftoff, and which basically meant that it didn't have the thrust to weight ratio to ascend quickly. So all of a sudden, it was kind of hovering sideways. That was quite an entertaining one. So, you know, they're still in their baby steps of trying to get, you know, things to orbit. So a long way to go there. But yes, there's so many of these companies now that are trying to do this and trying to get into the industry.
Yeah. Is your channel planning to cover all of the different companies out there trying to get to space?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some companies that are more restrictive. I often get a little bit of flack about not covering the Chinese Space Agency launches or the Indian Space Agency launches, and that's actually specifically due to copyright issues. We'll quite often get flags on video content. So if we can't show it, it's not very interesting to people. But yes, I cover all that I can, all that's interesting that we don't have, you know, copyright issues going on with.
All right, so I want to ask about Starship, and can you help my audience and myself understand the significance of Starship? So, you know, obviously it's a reusable rocket that's supposed to enable transportation to Mars. But beyond that, it's like, is there something about it that you think people are not understanding about Starship that maybe they should? Is there something much more significant than it's just a reusable rocket that's going to enable Mars?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the most significant part of Starship is the very cheap delivery of mass to orbit. If Starship could do nothing else but just that one thing, then it's an incredible success and unprecedented. If you can get things to orbit for orders of magnitude cheaper than what we can do it now, that's going to change everything, literally change everything. The reason why missions to space are so expensive is there's many insurances involved. There's obviously a great deal of testing. People want to make sure that this thing works right because it's going to cost them $100 million to launch it or $200 million to launch it or $300 whatever the cost is. So they spend so much in trying to make sure that there's nothing that's going to ever fail, but nobody's really prototyping this stuff. Like, nobody's going to just send up something that's a bit of a prototype to see if it works into orbit because it's cost them so much to get it there. Whereas if you lower that, all of a sudden people would innovate and say, oh, look, it's only going to cost us a couple of million to send it. Let's just send it. If it doesn't work, we'll, you know, reiterate it. We'll do that rapid design change that we see SpaceX doing, and it would be amazing to see the very, you know, significant milestones and things that come from that alone, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. This past week I was involved in like some helping some people leave Afghanistan, and I'm like, oh, I wish I had my own satellite or something or access where I can point it at the border to understand movements of people, like where, you know, people can get out. But it seems like, you know, super cheap space travel will enable things that are almost, I want to say not conceived yet, but it would just change the game completely where right now it's cost prohibitive to even think about it or try it.
Exactly.
But if it's so cheap, you know, you could buy a partial, you know, load on a Starship, and the Starship thing is so cheap and you can just try something crazy. It seems like it would just exponentially magnify the use cases in space. I mean, what are some potentially exciting or interesting use cases, you know, that you think, you know, maybe people haven't thought about or you might be excited about, you know, in terms of,
Yeah, well, you're certainly right about Starship being a big focus of what we're all looking at. And it's definitely a big focus of my channel. We start off every episode with updates just in the Starship development because it moves so quickly. But just to put it into perspective, we're talking there about the Terran R and the Neutron that was going to do eight metric tons or 20 metric tons. Starship is going to do something between 120 to 150 metric tons in one go. You can do a lot with that payload. And also the size of the payload bay. It's like a 9-meter wide vessel, this thing, much bigger than anybody else is even contemplating making at the moment. And, you know, first of all, it being fully reusable, there's so many little milestones they've got to go through to get that to work. And most importantly, I think for SpaceX is that it's cheap. It's made out of cheap material. It's all made out of stainless steel. The most expensive part of the whole system would be the rocket engines and obviously life support systems and things as it gets to that stage. But just as a payload delivery system, no life on board at all. Even if they just do that, that doesn't mean that they can't launch things that are other vessels and vehicles that do have all the life support systems in there. And I think to a degree, I think everybody gets a little hung up on the ultimate goal, which is obviously the colonization of Mars. But when it comes down to it, that may not necessarily be what happens in the longer term. It might be that there's, well, actually the Starship is the delivery system for all the cargo to Mars, but the actual, crew landing, are landing with a different vehicle. It really depends on how it goes. And things just don't move fast enough for Elon Musk to really, be happy with that. He wants people there now. He wants people there, within years. And it takes a long time to develop the life support systems needed. But even progressing to the moon and stuff is obviously important.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about the Mars launch window. So according to my understanding, at least every 2.2 years or so, you've got a Mars launch window. The next launch window is next year. Does SpaceX have any chance of sending anything, any payload to Mars? Are they even thinking about it? Or is it just are they just going to skip the 20? To launch window?
In terms of Starship, there's no way they would get a Starship there. There's so many hurdles to jump through before that point in 2022. Obviously, is only next. It's only months away now. The only way I think they would be able to do it is if they're in partnership with some other mission. So could they launch something? Could they launch a payload which has got its own propulsion system to go to Mars? They could potentially do that if they had the Starship up and running fully by next year. But yes, other than that, I haven't heard of anything. They're obviously targeting 2024 for moon missions, and I'm assuming also Mars missions still. That was the goal that we've heard for a long time. But 2022 is just a little close. I can't imagine we're going to see much.
Got it. So for the 2024, I guess it's probably close to the end of the year, 2024 mission, or what do you envision possible that SpaceX would send to Mars at that time? I mean, that's just coming up, and
Look, it's going to depend a little bit on the HLS award for SpaceX with NASA. If they have to shift focus a lot to meet all those goals and things for a moon mission, then maybe there won't be quite the amount of time to invest into Mars mission preparations. I suspect they will try to do both, even if to just a small degree, they're just doing a landing test on Mars and maybe nothing else, just with some payload, dummy payload. I guess if you're going to take a payload at all, you're best to just load it up with a heap of food that's non-perishable and water and all these sorts of supplies and just land something just to see if they can. And then, that payload's there useful for future missions in future years. But there's so many things so many hurdles to jump over before they can do this. I mean, just to give you the idea. So first of all, we've got to get to orbit. That's what they're trying to do right now, in the preparation for the full super heavy stack. This thing is an absolute monster. It's 120 meters tall, by far the biggest rocket to have ever launched. So first of all, it's got to get off the pad. And I think that's, that's the deep concern that we all have. I did a bit of a controversial video last week, which many people liked, a couple of people didn't like, which was talking about the explosive potential if something goes wrong on the pad. And that, although it can't so much do a full detonation or anything like that, it can still cause significant damage. So to the launch area especially, and to a degree, they need to get past the initial launches. They need to get that vehicle to orbit, and they also need to have it re-enter as well. Now, that's probably not going to happen all in this first mission, but if they can get to orbit, that would be fantastic. Anything at that point, I think, is icing on the cake. But the heat shield of Starship is something that's so intricate, and it hasn't really been done to this scale before. It's the largest heat shield to ever be created. Along with the Starship, of course, is the largest vehicle ever to be launched. So, of course, the heat shield would be the largest. But, there's some concern at the moment that the heat shield won't hold up during re-entry. There's a lot of tiles that are currently cracking. I'm not sure why they're cracking. Everyone keeps asking me the question. We don't really know. It could be more installation issues. But the forces, I think, as long as we can see it pass max Q and not have a heap of heat shield tiles fall off, I think that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it. I want to ask you about, so we have another question actually from Jana. She says, what's your best estimate for orbital flight? When will that take place? So I mean, you mentioned there's these different milestones. I mean, is SpaceX targeting some type of timeline, you think, for orbital flight?
Nothing official. I'm sure they would have their milestones internally that we wouldn't know about. So obviously, that's a great question there from Jana. The first orbital launch test we're hoping before the end of this year. There's going to be a few things dependent on that. The FAA, who obviously protects environments and makes sure that all of these launches are going to be safe for everybody around and that all the precautions are taken. They're still evaluating things, to my understanding, and trying to make sure that they can launch something of this magnitude without there being, dangers give us an unacceptable risk, I guess. So that's really the first thing. If we can see that before the end of the year, I think that would be great. Obviously Elon Musk wants that to be sooner rather than later. But then you've got the subsequent goals. So you have to have a flight and also the landings come back. So the booster has to come back and land eventually for this initial test. They're only going to be, as far as I understand, ditching them in the ocean. I haven't heard at least of any word of them recovering this first vehicle. I suspect it'll probably just break apart on impact with the ocean to a degree, and that'll be the end of it. There'll then be the next ships to be built and flown, and hopefully they'll be landing this and attempting to catch it out of the air with this gigantic tower that they're building right now, which to me still seems science fiction. I've got no idea if that's going to work. I think even SpaceX is kind of, it's like, hey, well, we're going to try it. It's like, it's going to be entertaining either way. So, yeah. And, even progressing further, you've got the offshore platforms, which may need to be built, especially if the FAA has a real problem with them launching many launches out of Boca Chica at that scale. And then you've got the refilling systems, which is further down the track, that have to be developed. And nothing's like this has been done before. To refill and to refuel Starship is huge. You need to have systems for zero boil-off. If you're taking fuel that's all cryogenic, unless you're actively cooling it, it will slowly evaporate away. It has to, because that's the way the energy works. You're getting hit by the sun from the sides of the Starship, and it's going to heat up those fuels. So unless you're actively cryogenically cooling it back again, it's not going to be able to keep its fuel load. In fact, you've got to, you have to essentially vent stuff. You've got to vent the gases so that you're not building up too much pressure. So they've got to deal with all those systems. And, to a scale, which has obviously never been seen before, you've got liquid oxygen, which is negative 183 degrees or something. You've got the negative 160 something for methane. You have to keep it at that temperature. So, it's interesting.
Yeah, easy stuff, I guess.
That's it. No problem.
It's challenging. I want to ask you about this one thing. So it seems like, from some of the videos and also Tim Dodd's interview with Elon Musk, they're working on like multiple starships right now, not just SN20, but it seems like, parts of SN21 or SN22 even. And it's like something about that, it's like I'm not completely understanding it, because usually you would like maybe finish one, fly it, and then figure out where to improve it, And then, I mean, if it's the engines or something that you're just using and it's proven, maybe you make a bunch of them. But it seems like, you're trying to fly the Starship, you would want to make major iterations. Why are they making, the next, couple of starships right now before even flying this SN20?
I think that's why they get so much publicity, because they're not afraid to prototype things rapidly and just throw them away. They don't even really care about an individual ship to a degree. In fact, It's not unusual for SpaceX to have fully built a vessel and then just get rid of it. It's like, it's already obsolete. We'll just get rid of it. And there's a couple of fully built starships sitting there in Boca Chica right now that, well, one that's never flown and the other one that's flown once, and they're just sort of keeping it there for the hell of it at the moment. So what's important for SpaceX is the machine that builds that machine. So they're not so much designing a starship, they're designing a manufacturing facility that makes starships fast. And that's actually the most important thing. Because they're not dealing with things like carbon fiber, and all this sort of stuff, they can build these things out incredibly cheap with stainless steel. And, it's more the exercise in prototyping that they're trying to improve and hone.
I mean, that's fascinating because it makes sense now, because if you make something, even if you don't use it, you're making the machine that makes the machine. You're making the process to make it.
That's right.
Learning it. And you don't want to get stalled because your, current starship isn't flying right now. So you want to keep pushing the envelope. Same stuff. Is the FAA, are you going to be approving, Starship SN20 launch anytime soon? Or are we thinking by the end of the year? Or what's the latest, you think?
I think we'll definitely know soon. But yes, we don't have any official information. I've asked this question a few times on Twitter more recently. It's like, how are things progressing? Is there any progress at all? Or, what's the go? As far as we are aware, they're doing a full environmental impact survey and things like that. If something of that scale explodes, and it's not going to so much explode, there'll be like a massive fireball, as Elon Musk says. It's going to be very unlikely, unless you sort of have things impact and mix in such a rapid way that things can detonate. I don't think it's going to be as bad as what there's a lot, but every channel that's a big fan of SpaceX, there's probably another channel that's very critical of what they're trying to do and things like that as well. So, it's important to understand the science behind it. And although I'm not an expert in the potential damage that something like that could do if there's a worst case scenario, I think it's a lot less than what a lot of other channels are claiming. But all the same, I'm not an expert in it. They're not experts in it. Who are experts in it are the FAA, and they're trying to get a good understanding of how this works, and they're going through that process. It's the big question. It's probably the biggest issue, I think, remaining before they can actually take flight. They've got to get the ground support equipment finished. They're quite close to that now. We're seeing the fueling arms and stuff go up on the massive tower that they're building, the orbital launch tower. So that's exciting to see just over the last couple of days. So they're getting quite close, I think. We'll see a lot of testing with the ship and the booster separately, booster 4, ship 20. As you say, they're already working on booster 5 and ship 21 in the background while all this is going on. But, sadly, we just don't really know at this stage. We're kind of in a little bit of a limbo phase. We're hoping that as soon as it's actually physically ready to launch, which we would think is probably within the next month or so, that the FAA has given us some more news. That's going to be very important. And SpaceX are definitely not going to launch without FAA approval. That would be insane.
I've noticed a lot of urgency from Elon Musk regarding SpaceX and the Starship.
Yep.
It feels like to me it's more urgent. It just there's a fire under his butt. It's cartoon that was like, was it the Roadrunner? These Wily Coyote, they fire in the butt. You're running with the fire in your butt, just trying to go fast as you can. That's the imagery I'm getting the past several months on SpaceX. But I haven't followed it obviously as closely as you have. But I'm wondering if you notice any kind of boost of urgency, any additional focus, attention. Because, for example, back in 2018 or 19, it was Elon was so focused on just trying to have Tesla survive and, make the Model 3. And sure, SpaceX was pushing the envelope, but it seems like right now there's this very encompassing drive to pushing super fast. Can you share any insights on that?
Sure. I mean, Elon's said a number of times, he's almost divvied up his lifespan. He sort of said, right, okay, I'm going to live for another, 40 years, hopefully 40, 50 years. If it takes this long, he's working back from Mars, okay, full colony on Mars. Can that happen? Here's all the different milestones working backwards. And from his point of view, he sees it as they're already behind. If he wants to get there and have a sustainable, you know, civilization on Mars, they're already behind where he wants to be. So he's like treating it as if it's already too late. And I think it's possibly more of a personal thing for him as well, that he wants to see that happen. There's many other stories that have come out from him there in regards to what happens if there is an apocalypse. You know, we've only got a certain amount of time before any sort of risk. It could be an artificial intelligence risk. It could be a pandemic one. These things can happen. And he's like, well, you know, life being multiplanetary would be a great thing. You know, it gives us a backup, and it gives us a lot of technology that we can use to help improve life here on Earth. I think that's something that a lot of people that don't really follow space, like, oh, you know, I don't care if rockets launch, what do I care? It's like, well, we use so much technology that's driven from space exploration. If we had no space industry, it would be amazing to see what the difference would be, whether we would have things, you know, we obviously wouldn't have things like GPS or incredible batteries or all these things that are required for space exploration to evolve into what it has been today. And that's really what inspires it. Like it pays itself back 10 times over. It's one of those things people don't really get.
And it's interesting, the whole thing of looking backwards, you know, on his possible lifespan and seeing, you know, if they're on target or not. It's interesting because a lot of Elon's goals, it seems like, are somewhat aspirational, kind of this colony on Mars or sustainable energy, you know, kind of, in a way, protection from rogue AI, et cetera. But those inherently, I don't know if they have this urgency of timeline, but it seems like this, the way you frame it, this like looking back and, you know, we might not have time or we're late already. And yeah, I get this image or this picture of like, you know, there's a delay, there's a problem, it's like a week is lost, you know? And it's like Elon is just you know, frustrated, but he understands the significance and he's like, it's such a big loss, but it doesn't feel like, it feels like Elon is in his own world of where that means a lot, you know, a week lost time. And I mean, I think your explanation actually helps a lot to kind of frame a little bit of that, you know, that urgency and that thinking.
I mean, if you think of it from his point of view, he's built this, he's going to have built this stuff, all this up over the course of his lifetime, and he wants to see the ultimate outcome of that. He doesn't want to be, we still haven't passed the moon or something, and he's kind of, you know, on his last legs, wishing that they had have done more to be able to fulfill his lifelong dream, obviously, which is to try to become a multiplanetary species. People will sort of target him a little bit with this sort of stuff, saying that this is unrealistic or that's unrealistic. I don't think it's unusual for anyone that changes the world to have ever had everything realistic in their mind. You've only got to look at the amazing people of the past, the Einsteins and the Teslas and all these people that had, you know, quite hard lives, and they changed the world to such a degree. And they, you know, they, to a degree, they were a little eccentric as well. And I think it could probably be said that Elon Musk can sometimes have some of those personality traits. So, yeah.
Definitely. So I want to toss out an idea to you, get your feedback. So my theory or hypothesis is once, you know, SpaceX launches their Starship, but also gets this refilling kind of, you know, exercise either done or like they actually show it, I think there's going to be a change of perception where up until now, Elon Musk, there's a lot of skeptics and doubters kind of Mars and civilization, whatever. Like there's like the hardcore SpaceX or space, you know, fanatics that believe in it, but most people, it's just a fantasy, right? I think there's something that's going to shift when people see Starship like refilling, you know, and the whole thing of this is actually happening before our eyes. It's like, are we really going to be a spacefaring civilization? Are we really going, this is the next era of human history in a way. It's like, I don't think people, besides the space fanatics right now, like other people don't realize that this is the dawning of the next era of human history in a way. But
that's exactly right.
It feels like we're getting close, you know, and once this is demonstrated or what, and especially when the first Starship goes to Mars too. I mean, it just seems like such an exciting, like amazing, momentous period to be living in and to observe, you know. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, this is like an epoch-defining thing. You know, you've got the invention of the wheel and you've got, you know, various stages through history. You know, you've got the, obviously the first moon landing, but to actually become multi-planetary, that's an epoch-defining thing. That's civilization changing. And it's hard to really understand how people wouldn't be inspired about that story, or at least appreciate the goal. There's people that need housing and there's people that need medical care and things around the world. So why should we be spending money on this when we should be helping that? So, well, we can spend money on multiple things. So we do, just because we need to spend money in certain areas, that doesn't mean we can't spend money in other areas. And what people also probably don't fully understand is, yes, Elon Musk might be the second richest person in the world, however they equate that. But he's also employing, I don't know how many thousand people, you would probably know this better than I do, across Tesla and SpaceX. You know, he's changed the lives of 100,000 people. I don't know. That's a significant thing to be able to say alone. So it's employment for so many people as well as this amazing, goal. But as you say, as soon as you start to see refilling and this full mass to orbit in a full reusable sense, that really does change everything. I think many people just don't still comprehend it, and or either that or they don't believe it. It's like, it'll never happen. And I suppose there is a difference between what SpaceX has done in the past with Falcon 9, which is kind of, it's an amazing thing. And I remember being absolutely thrilled by the initial landings back in, I think it was 2016, 2015. They were incredible, and they're still incredible. But to a degree, the technology, the rocket engines, all those sorts of things are still kind of built based on similar stuff that was around in the past. So it's improved, made cheaper, all that sort of thing. But it's not kind of a real groundbreaking shift, whereas Starship is a groundbreaking shift. That is something we've never been able to do. Refueling is something we've never done, not to that extent anyway. We've done small refueling exercises just with International Space Station fuelage and things like that. We've never done something this significant. We're talking about shifting 130 tons, 140 tons of propellant from one ship to another in zero gravity. That's something that is going to take a little engineering to get right.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you have kids, but I mean, I have two young ones.
Yeah, two.
You have two. How old are you?
Yeah. Eight and 12. So yeah, it's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Like my young ones are 3 and 6, and they're like fascinated by, you know, SpaceX and rockets. And part of it is like, I feel like the mission or the adventure is so wide and unknown. It's like, where do you go in space? You know, it's like, and it's so ambitious, and the problems to solve to get there is so daunting. It just feels like this such an intriguing, you know, like area that is so fascinating that I think in the next decade, it just feels like it's going to grow and grow. And I don't know, with your kids, I mean, are they into all this, or what were their kind of reactions?
They are kind of forced into it to a degree because I talk about it so much. They find it interesting. They watch the launches with me and things like that, especially the bigger events, and we'll certainly all be sitting down to watch the first Super Heavy launch. But, you know, it's one of those things where they're kind of interested in it simply because they hear so much about it. In a normal situation, maybe they wouldn't be so much. You know, they're very into Minecraft and things of that nature. My eldest certainly loves science. It's his favorite subject, so he finds all this stuff quite fascinating.
Do you have any plans to visit Boca Chica Starbase at all in the future?
Absolutely. if I can get there in the next, I would have liked to have already been there. Our plans were to go there late last year originally, which of course was never going to happen. Likewise, I would have liked to have done it this year, which is obviously also not going to happen. Sadly, I'm about as far away as you can really get without going into orbit. I'm about as far away as you can get down here on the opposite side of the world. So, it's been difficult because I would love to go and watch even one of these Starship launches. It'd be just such an incredible experience. And believe it or not, I've never seen a SpaceX launch live ever. I've seen them all remotely, and one day I will make it to do that.
Yeah. I'm hoping to head out there in about a month or so. We'll see if I can make it. My kids. Starlink. So, what can you tell us about Starlink? Elon Musk recently announced 100,000 subscribers, and service is rolling out. Like, how is Starlink going, in your opinion? Right? Is it going well?
Yeah.
And what are the hurdles they still have to kind of overcome to expand their service reliably?
Yeah. I think one of the bigger hurdles at the moment is fighting the legal action that's always sort of going on. You know, we've seen attempts to stop Starlink by Viasat, however you pronounce it. That is, and they keep sort of fighting that. I think there's a new claim out there now. I haven't actually researched this a great deal, to be honest. There's always someone trying to stop this. And there's also a lot of groups that are concerned about space debris and things. That's actually a valid concern. One of the main issues, I think, with Starlink's going to essentially be how many subscribers can they get to this service, and can it be enough to facilitate the financial side of actually launching that amount of that number of satellites into orbit. I think they're talking still total roughly 45,000 satellites. They've only done one of the shells of this so far, and they're now waiting on the polar launches. So I've heard a lot of feedback in the comments. It's, SpaceX have stopped launching Starlink, so it's all a failure. It's like, no, they're getting prepared to launch the polar satellites now, which are going to be laser-linked satellites. And these have got to launch from a different facility. That's why we've seen the drone ship, Of Course I Still Love You, move to another part of the world to go and actually make these catches that are obviously going to be from polar launches. So there's been quite a big shift. And the initial shells, as I said, that's already finished. And until they get the appropriate approvals, I guess, for the next shell out, they're kind of all intermingled, these shells now. They're all down at that 500-kilometer altitude range, I think. And it helps keep latency down and keeps the whole thing fast, but it also means that they stay in orbit for less time, because eventually they will drag down and be captured. They've only got a certain amount of fuel on board each one to keep on sort of orbit raising. And that's where the financials come into it, and actually where I quite like your insight at some point. It's like, how many customers do they need to get to be able to keep that entire thing alive? I think the end goal is great, because you can supply internet anywhere in the world, no matter what your location is. As long as you can see the sky, you can have great fast internet, and that's something that a lot of the world don't have. So they're supplying to people that just don't have the connection ability, to a degree, even third world areas would hugely benefit them. People say, but you're not going to have a bunch of people with no money that can't afford this go and sign up. It's like, no, but you might have community centres in these areas that are shared access for everybody around. People in that part of the world, they're not going to have individual connections, but group connections, sure. That's life-changing for them to have fast internet. And, with education comes the improvements of you've only got to look at terrible things are going on in Afghanistan, all these places where to have fast, reliable educational access is incredibly beneficial. So I hope it changes the world in that area. So I obviously hope for it to be a big success, but from a financial point of view, no idea.
For me, it's like when I look at Starlink, I'm like very surprised that they already are at 100,000 subscribers, because didn't they just start service like just several months ago? I mean, when was it?
I think it's still technically in its beta phase.
I mean, I guess they did have the early dishes, kind of around around the end of the year or beginning of the year? I think it was around that time. Winter.
Then, I think the dishes have been sort of out for about a year, but they were only being used internally for testing until 8 months ago, six months ago, something like that.
And then they're ramping, but then, like, I was expecting a much slower ramp. It just feels like if they're already at 100,000 right now, I mean, you would imagine they would be at least at 1 million by the end of next year, you know, if things continue to ramp.
Yeah. Look, that seems feasible. I think you can almost have that initial sort of acceleration where the enthusiasts all get on board very quickly, regardless of how reliable the service is. Because obviously, as I don't yet believe that the first shell is completely operational. Like, it's all launched, all the satellites are there, but I think some are still making their way into their final positions. So there'd still be a bit of sporadic connection issues going on. So it's not 100% yet. As soon as they've got a shell, especially a second shell, then it should be very reliable. But it'll just remain to be seen how many people jump on board. I think as soon as you've got a good percentage of people that are using it, praising it, then it just, you know, word of mouth spreads. Just like with Tesla or, you know, anything like this, they don't market their own product as their marketing, and you know, people like us talking about them every 5 seconds on YouTube probably. So I'm interested to know as well. Starlink's one of those projects that it seems extremely when you first hear about it, it seems implausible, but then as you see all these launch, it's like, wow, this is actually happening.
Yeah. I was camping a year or two ago, and then I was in this place. It was like the desert, no internet anywhere for like miles and miles, and like no one in the campsite has internet or phone or nothing. And I had this moment of realization. I'm like, I don't want food. I don't want shelter. I don't want whatever. I just want internet. You know, like, that is the key, right? And I was like, I think Starlink has something. It's a necessity. It's an essential of life now, right?
It's very hard not to be connected.
Yeah, just to what it brings on. You know, all of the knowledge and value. You would maybe like sacrifice if you had a choice between no internet and lots of food and whatever, and you know, luxury, or internet and very just middle class or low class life. You might just choose the internet, you know, because like
do you want great food and no internet, or do you want just ration packs and internet? It's like, yes, the ration packs, thanks.
Exactly, right. You get on Twitter and YouTube with your ration packs. But it got me to think, like, I think there will be demand for space for Starlink, just because it's high speed, low latency internet anywhere in the world. Yeah. There are a lot of people in places that, you know, need that. Financially wise, like, you know, if they get 1 million subscribers, hypothetically at $1,000 a year, that's simply just, you know, $1 billion revenue. If they make their way to 10 million subscribers, let's say 2 to 3 years after that, that's $10 billion in revenue. But you can legitimately make a case, I think, to do like, you know, maybe even a 20 to 30 time multiple off of their revenue, let's say in 2 or 3 years. So, I mean, Starlink itself could be this massive, massive business that really, you know, funds a lot of, you know, SpaceX's goals. I mean, what's your take kind of on Starlink? Is it the thing that Elon's hoping that really funds everything, or are there other like options he has? You know, obviously the launch business is still there, but then I'm thinking, if you bring down the launch cost so much, it's like, I don't know if you're able to grow the revenue, because you're slashing the cost so much, right? So, I mean, is there anything else that SpaceX can rely on, or is Starlink kind of, you know, their thing for the next 5 years at least?
Yeah, well, I mean, and obviously this really depends a lot on the whole goal of Starship, because if you can launch, you know, currently they're doing 60 in one launch on a Falcon 9. If you can do several hundred on a Starship in one go, and it's also a cheaper launch vehicle than Falcon 9, which is that's the goal of it. It's only supposed to be a few million dollars turnaround for the Starship. You know, that may be aspirational, by the way. I don't know if I ever, you know, I think Elon Musk tweeted out once that it was going to be roughly $2 million per launch or something. So I don't really believe that. I think it's going to, like, just the servicing and stuff will probably be higher. But, you know, it remains to be seen. Who knows? It could be true. But if you can then lower the launch of all the satellites, that's going to be the main thing that helps Starlink, because there's only so much bandwidth capability that each satellite can pass through. And that's that's kind of where the financials start to get interesting. It's like, okay, if you max out every satellite that's in the network across all the populated areas, how many customers can you have simultaneously before that entire network starts to get congested? And these are the questions that I'm quite interested in. I've got no idea how to work them out, but I'm quite interested in them. You know, is it many millions of people, or is it not that many? Because it has to be obviously feasible. I actually honestly believe that what a lot of the funding that SpaceX will get from projects like Starlink will actually be more, they may end up be more government based and military based and things like that, because they all want to be mobile connected everywhere very fast. So I suspect that there's the consumer grade stuff, and then there'll probably be like military and government grade stuff. So there's also, I think, a lot of additional funding there that's not being talked about because it's all very secretive, I would say.
Sure. What do you think about this idea? So, one of my guests on my channel, his name is James Dauma. He does AI, and we have a lot of episodes on full self-driving. He had this interesting kind of idea where Starlink possibly, and I'd love to hear your feedback, could be used to create an alternative cell network. So basically, hypothetically, let's say you have a city area, you have, you know, a bunch of these Starlink antennas that are different, obviously, than consumer, but they're like all perhaps linked together and linked to satellites, and they give kind of like a, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say a Wi-Fi signal, but like a cell signal out, right, to the city. So you blanket cover, you know, a region using, you know, kind of a different type of maybe high-powered, you know, satellite dish that connects directly to the satellites. And you basically, you know, create your own, you know, national cell network or whatever, global. I would imagine like the revenue would just be insane with that, because now you're taking your total addressable market, not just for rural people with, you know, slow connections, you're bringing it into everyone who has a cell phone plan, right? That could change into that. Have you thought about that? Is that possible, realistic, or?
I don't really know enough about telecommunications to really know how all that would fit together. I mean, as soon as you've got a solid connection to any other ground station, which is essentially what Starlink is right now, that they're not communicating with each other. It's essentially communicating with one satellite that bounces your signal back down to a ground station. So it's all being passed through. And that's where the laser links come in the future. And what they're doing with these next polar ones is that they're going to be able to communicate together with these laser links. So, you know, you might have your signal being transmitted straight up to a satellite, and then that's being beamed across and then repeated. And it's in some cases, I believe, based on a lot of the research we've seen with Starlink, great guy Mark Handley, who did some great simulations of this, in many situations, especially over long distances, the latency can actually be less than even the fiber networks that currently exist. So if you just Australia as an example, for me to have this conversation with you right now, I'm sure we're probably being routed right around the world, you know, out through Asia and up through Europe and over into, you know, it's definitely not a direct line in any way. Although, again, I'm not an expert, but if you can then instead have that going straight up to a satellite and then passing down through, you know, 10, 20, different Starlink satellites, then our latency right now would be much better. And I think that's where the real power could be, and where things like this is where the big money starts to get made. This is where your share market started, like, oh, hey, if I can do a transaction, you know, milliseconds earlier than what I could before, then that's worth the many thousands of dollars that I can invest into this particular link. It might be that maybe in the future Starlink is sold based off low latency around the world rather than bandwidth volume and things like this, which, you know, you never really know where these industries are going to take you. But look, it's interesting. The point you make there is interesting. I just don't know a lot about ground stations and what they're capable of.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea because, like, you know, it's again what space enables. We don't completely understand how, like, the end minutes of it, right? So if you think about it conceptually from, like, let's say using first principle thinking, you have basically a global satellite, you know, network, internet network that's connecting, you know, everyone on this planet to the internet, you would imagine that could be used to leverage and create some type of more, you know, cellular networks or other type of always on the go networks that could be monetized in a different way than just, you know, a rural setting. But yeah, we'll see. Yeah. I mean, it just makes me more bullish on SpaceX just because I think the possibilities are, like, fundamentally, it just seems like what a crazy business, you know? Like,
yeah, it is nuts.
40,000 plus satellites, you know, or global internet. It's like,
It is crazy. And of course, the as long as it never causes any sort of Kessler syndrome, Kessler effect, that's the main thing that people obviously are afraid of with big networks. And this is not just SpaceX, any network. It can just be general space junk up there. But the more stuff's up there hurtling around at 27,000 kilometers an hour, the more chance there is that one of those things might run into something else and cause some sort of cascade, not unlike what we saw with the movie Gravity years ago. And that's what people are, I guess, a little bit afraid of with these big networks. You know, SpaceX aren't the only ones wanting to do it. Blue Origin, obviously, Amazon have said that they wanted to do that as well. They just need to get a launch vehicle that can get to orbit to do it.
So a lot of people have asked me on my Twitter thread there about how you are able to make videos, like kind of what's your process, because you pack a lot of information and it seems like you put a lot of time into production editing because you're, you know, taking various sources. So what is the process for creating a video for you, like from A to B? And are you doing it yourself? Do you have a team? You know, who does what? I'm just curious about everything.
Yeah, I've definitely got a team. It used to be that I was doing it all myself until probably a bit over a year ago. And I was also doing 3 days a week at my other job still. I had no life. I was basically just working all the time, and something was going to change. I had to change. Otherwise, I was just going to go insane. Basically, the start of the process tends to be about now in the week. You know, you've had a few days of dust settle from the video that we launched on Saturday. So it's Saturday morning US time. The video goes up. Let the dust settle on that for a few days. By then, we've got new news that's occurring. Like, you know, just this week, we've had the Astra launch. We've had CRS-23. These few things are now ready to write about, right? They've happened since the video went live. So we'll write about those. We'll obviously be covering all the Starship stuff like we do every week, with all the terrific contacts that we've got on site. Love every single person that we communicate with that allows us to use their stuff and cross promote them. RGV aerial photography, absolute champion Mauricio, who does these amazing flyers every week. And, you know, and although myself and other YouTubers that helped kick off that business for him, It was a significant thing for him. Now that he's fully self-funded and has this as a business, that's incredible. And, you know, and in return, he's been wonderful to us, letting us use his photography and stuff. We try not to use too much of it because we want him to be able to promote his own stuff. So just a few select slices to help keep him growing and also have people engaged in what we're doing. So it's this, again, it's this team space thing that really makes this work. In many other industries, everyone would be very restrictive. Oh, no, you can't use our stuff. That's our stuff. It's like, yeah, but it's social crossflow. If you've got multiple people all feeding back, then it works and it works well. And there's other examples where they haven't followed that social model and they've not grown at all. It's like it really is a collaborative experience. And the stuff with NASA Space Flight and Boca Chica Gal, who's been down there since day dot, and right early in the early days, like going back a year and a half ago now, they had no YouTube following really at all, NASA Space Flight. And as soon as we started talking about this, we were just shouting them out. And they're way bigger than me now. I mean, they've gone from basically no following at all over a year and a half to now being, you know, 400. They're growing so fast, I can't keep up with the numbers. They're like 100,000 ahead of me now. It's only 6 months ago they were smaller than me. Now they're like hundreds of thousands ahead. So, you know, and that again has been incredibly beneficial relationship to have. And hopefully we've helped, you know, at least at that kickoff very, very much. And you know, the researchers that work with me, you know, a couple of great guys, Brendan Lewis, Brenton as well. We all sort of work together scripting. We've got some people in the US that work with us, and they're amazing people that just love this stuff and are happy to help out. You know, so we pay them for their time. We pay editors, a couple in the UK that we have running with us as well. So that I can record all my A-roll here behind me, get all that ready, get all the sponsorships organized and all that sort of thing and send it out. And then, you know, next day I've got half an edited video that I can continue on with. So, and then it all repeats again every week.
Got it. So you start with the research phase. And so you and others, your researchers are putting together some type of script. And then you have the, your production. Kind of editors will take the B-roll from places, match everything, and show it to you. But then that's not all, because you need to iterate off of it, maybe, right? Like add on stuff. And you do the same thing with your scripters and your editors, and you get to a final version. And then you have sponsors and everything else, and recording yourself.
Exactly.
How do you manage all that? That's a lot of people, it seems like. Yeah.
Yeah. Just great people, honestly. It's great people, and thank you so much to the team that works with me. I wouldn't be able to turn around the amount of content I do. I think it's great. If you look at a video of mine, say, a year and a half ago, they were much shorter, much less detailed, much less effort in editing, and it's just grown to this thing. You know, the Patreon support as well. I mean, support isn't just from the people that I pay out, it's from the revenue that comes in, the sponsors, the patrons, obviously the YouTube revenue as well, and it all adds up into this thing. Even, you know, merch sales, sometimes they sell a few shirts as well. But, you know, it's without the entire thing together working, it doesn't happen. It can't happen. So, I'm just so incredibly grateful to the people that have chosen to work with me, and I hope it's beneficial for them as well.
Yeah, awesome. Will Lopez, he says, what advice does he have for anyone interested in working for SpaceX? I actually get this question actually quite often. Do you have any ideas? Do you just apply?
Yeah.
Any connections? How do you make your resume, or you know, you stand out?
Yeah, I mean, I guess connections are always good. You know, it's sometimes not what you know, it's who you know. But I would think that, especially with aerospace, it's definitely what you know. So you kind of need to be across both of those. I'm certainly no expert and not an engineer myself, so I'm not even really 100% sure what sort of qualifications you need to even get your foot in the door at somewhere like SpaceX. But, I mean, down at Boca Chica, they take on so many people, thousands of people, and they're not aerospace, they're not all aerospace engineers and things. Some are just terrific welders or, you know, anything like that. And so these skills can, there's no reason why you can't get the foot in the door to do one of the more repetitive tasks, I guess, and sort of build your way up. But the first thing I would be doing if I really wanted to work for SpaceX would be getting myself to Boca Chica and getting any position at all, just to meet people and, at the same time, obviously doing the appropriate qualifications you need to get into the area that you want. Also, I mean, just because Blue Origin's shifting staff here and there, they would also be taking a lot of great people as well. So, you know, if you've got a bit of experience at Blue Origin or United Launch Alliance, that is a good thing to have on your resume for SpaceX if that's where you would ultimately like to end up. Not be afraid, just try to communicate and meet as many people as you possibly can.
Marcus, it's been fun chatting with you, getting to know you and your stuff and your process. You are on Twitter. I'll link to your Twitter account in your video description. I'll link to your YouTube account. One of the things that why I'm kind of so excited is I just feel like covering SpaceX, but also the journey of SpaceX. This is like, feels we're so early, you know, like, this is like, feels so, so early. And already there's so much momentum, there's so much community and excitement. And we're just like, just in the early innings. And it's just so exciting what's going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years, you know? And to see you in the forefront covering it you know, unpacking it for people. I think it's awesome.
It's been an incredibly rewarding experience so far. And, you know, as you say, we just happened to get in at the right point. We could see what was going on with SpaceX. We could see the long-term plan right from when they first launched the international the RTS, I think it was called back then, Interplanetary Transport System. So, you know, back then, that was, I think, 2016, and that was incredibly exciting back then, but it seemed like a pipe dream. You know, this is ever going to happen. And this, we're right now, over the next couple of months, going to see this vehicle launch, hopefully the next couple of months. And everybody that loves this, you know, obviously we're on YouTube, you know, between 300,000 and 400,000 subscribers. So a lot of people love this topic. And yeah, 50,000 or something on Twitter now. So yeah, I just passed that milestone the other day. So it's been great chatting to you as well, Dave. It's awesome to meet you and like-minded people.
Yeah. We'd love to have you on again on the channel to get an update on SpaceX stuff. And I'll definitely be in touch. All right. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Dave. Right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye all.